passers-by and the Pondiena, before moving on, turned their heads to gaze for a moment at those two motionless features of the landscape, the man on the embankment, the fiacre on the quay. He, too, bears his cross. Jean Valjean had continued on his course once more, and did not stop again. The going was more and more laborious. The level of the tunnels varies, the average height being about 5 feet 6 inches, based on a man's height. Jean Valjean was forced to bend over so as not to bang Marius against the vaulted ceiling. He had to duck at every step, then straighten up again, groping the wall constantly. The dampness of the stones and the sliminess of the floor meant they were useless as supports for either hands or feet. He stumbled in the city's hideous shit-heap. The intermittent reflections from the air vents appeared only at very widely spaced intervals, and the light was so wan that daylight was like moonlight. All the rest was mist, miasma, opacity, blackness. Jean Valjean was hungry and thirsty, thirsty especially. And that place, like the sea, is full of water that can't be drunk. His strength, which, as we know, was prodigious and barely diminished a fraction with age, thanks to his chaste and sober life, was beginning to give way. He was getting tired, and as his strength diminished, the weight of his burden grew. Marius, who was perhaps dead, weighed heavily as inert bodies do. Jean Valjean was carrying him in such a way that his chest was not squashed, and he could breathe as freely as possible. He could feel the rats darting between his legs. One of them was frightened enough to bite him. From time to time, a breath of fresh air came to him through the covers of the manholes and revived him. It might have been 3 in the afternoon when he reached the ring sewer. At first he was amazed at the sudden widening. He suddenly found himself in a gallery where his outstretched hands did not reach the walls on either side and beneath a vault that his head did not touch. The grand sewer is indeed 8 feet wide and 7 feet high. At the point where the Montmartre sewer joins the grand sewer, 2 other underground galleries, that of the Rue de Provence and that of the Abattoir, intersect and form a square. Having to choose between these 4 lanes, anyone less wise would have been undecided. Jean Valjean took the widest, meaning the ring sewer. But this is where the question returned, uphill or downhill? He sensed the situation was urgent and that it was now vital to get to the Seine, whatever the risk. In other words, to go downhill. He took the left. And just as well for him that he did, for it would be a mistake to think that the ring sewer has 2 exits, one somewhere at Bercy, the other somewhere at Passy, and that it is, as its name would suggest, the underground ring around the Paris of the right bank. The grand sewer, you must remember, is nothing more than the old Ménilmontant stream, and it ends, if you go up it, in a dead end, that is, in its old starting point, which was its spring at the foot of the Ménilmontant knoll. It is not directly connected to the drain that collects the Paris runoff starting from the Popincourt quartier and emptying into the Seine through the Amelot sewer above the old Île Louvier. This drain, which completes the outfall sewer, is separated from it, under the Rue Ménilmontant itself, by a solid wall that marks the drainage divide between the upstream and downstream runoff. If Jean Valjean had gone up the gallery, then, after huge effort, shattering fatigue, gasping his last in darkness, he would have hit a wall. He would have been sunk. At a pinch, by retracing his steps a short distance and taking the Fille du Calvaire tunnel on the condition of not hesitating at the underground bifurcation under the Boucherade junction, but taking the Saint-Louis tunnel instead, then, on the left, the Saint-Gilles tunnel, then, by turning right and avoiding the Saint-Sébastien gallery, he would have been able to get to the Amelot sewer, and from there, as long as he didn't go astray in the sort of F formation under the Bastille, he would have reached the outlet on the Seine near the Arsenal. But to do that, he would have had to know the enormous coral reef that is the sewer inside out, along with all its ramifications and all its interconnections. Well, we said before, and we'll say it again, he knew nothing about this grisly network of tunnels in which he was wending his way. And if anyone had asked him what he was in, he would have answered, in the dark. His instinct served him well. Going downhill did indeed mean possible salvation. He left behind, on his right, the 2 tunnels that branch out in a claw shape under the Rue Lafitte and the Rue Saint-Georges and the long forked tunnel of the Chaussée d'Antin. A bit beyond a tributary that was most likely the Madeleine drain, he paused. He was very weary. A pretty big air vent, probably the manhole in the Rue d'Anjou, provided an almost sharp light, with movements as gentle as those of a man handling his own wounded brother. Jean Valjean laid Marius down on the bank of the sewer. Marius's bloody face looked to be lying at the bottom of a grave in the white light from the air vent. His eyes were closed, his matted hair stuck to his temples like dried brushes that had been dipped in the color red, his hands hung down, lifeless, his limbs were cold. There was coagulated blood at the corners of his mouth. A clot of blood had built up in the knot of his cravat. His shirt was sinking into his wounds. The cloth of his coat was rubbing against the gaping gashes in his living flesh. Jean Valjean pulled his clothes aside with the tips of his fingers and placed his hand on his chest. His heart was still beating. Jean Valjean ripped up his own shirt, bandaged the wounds as best he could, and staunched the flowing blood. Then, bending over the still unconscious and almost unbreathing Marius in the twilight gloom, he glared at him with inexpressible hatred. In disturbing Marius's clothes, he had found in his pockets two things: the bread, forgotten there since the day before, and Marius's wallet. He ate the bread and opened the wallet. In the first compartment he found the four lines written by Marius. "You will recall them. My name is Marius Pontmercy. Take my body to my grandfather, Monsieur Gillenormand, Rue des Filles du Calvaire, No. 6 in the Marais." Jean Valjean read these four lines in the light of the air vent, and remained for a moment as though absorbed in himself, repeating to himself in a murmur, "Rue des Filles du Calvaire, No. 6, Monsieur Gillenormand." He put the wallet back in Marius's pocket. He had eaten, his strength had returned. He put Marius on his back again, carefully rested his head on his right shoulder, and began descending the sewer again. The grand sewer, aligned following the riverbed of the Ménilmontant Valley, is almost 2 leagues long. It is paved for a considerable part of its course. But this torch of Paris street names, which we are shining for the reader's benefit on Jean Valjean's subterranean course, was not available to Jean Valjean. Nothing told him which part of the city he was crossing or what way he had come. Only the growing faintness of the pools and points of light he came across periodically showed him that the sun was withdrawing from the footpath above and day was gradually coming to a close, and the rumbling of the carriages overhead, having gone from endless to intermittent, then almost ceasing altogether, made him conclude that he was no longer under the center of Paris, but was approaching some out-of-the-way area, somewhere near the outer boulevards, or the quays furthest away. Wherever there are fewer houses and fewer streets, the sewer has fewer air vents. The darkness was getting thicker around Jean Valjean. He continued to forge ahead, though, regardless, groping in the gloom. This gloom promptly became terrible. With sand, as with women, there is a kind of fineness that is perfidious. He felt that he was stepping into water and that he had beneath his feet not pavement now, but mud. It sometimes happens on certain stretches of Breton or Scottish coast that a man, a traveller or a fisherman, trudging along the beach at low tide far from shore, suddenly realizes he has been struggling for some minutes. The sand is like pitch underfoot. His soles stick to it. It's no longer sand, it's glue. The beach is perfectly dry, but with every step a person takes, as soon as he lifts his foot, the footprint it leaves fills with water. The eye, though, has not registered any change. The vast, wide beach is all of a piece and peaceful. Everywhere the sand looks the same. Nothing distinguishes solid ground from ground that no longer is. The little gleeful cloud of sandflies continues to hop tumultuously over the wayfarer's feet. The man follows his route, forges straight ahead, leaning in toward the ground, tries to get closer to the hinterland. He's not worried. What's there to worry about? Only he feels somehow as though his feet are getting heavier with each step he takes. Suddenly he sinks. he sinks by 2 or 3 inches. Clearly, he is not on the right track. He stops to get his bearings. All of a sudden, he looks at his feet. His feet have disappeared. The sand has buried them. He pulls his feet out of the sand. He tries to retrace his steps. He swivels round. He sinks deeper. The sand comes up to his ankles. He yanks himself out and throws himself to the left. The sand comes halfway up to his calves. He throws himself to the right. The sand comes up to the backs of his knees. Then he recognizes with unspeakable terror that he is caught in quicksand, and that that awful medium in which a man can no more walk than a fish can swim is lying under him. He chucks away his load, if he has one. He lightens himself like a ship in distress. It is already too late. The sand is above his knees. He calls out. He waves his hat or his handkerchief. The sand is gaining on him more and more. If the beach is deserted, if the land is too far away, if the sandbank is too notorious, if there is no hero about, then that's it. He is condemned to being sucked down and buried alive. He is condemned to that appalling interment, long, inexorable, implacable, impossible to slow down or speed up, going on for hours, never ending, that grabs you as you stand, free and in the pink of health, and pulls you by the feet, and at every effort you make, at every cry you let out, drags you under a bit farther, that seems to punish you for your resistance by redoubling its grip, that pulls a man slowly into the ground, leaving him all the time in the world to gaze at the horizon, the trees, the lush green countryside, the smoke from villages in the plain, the sails of ships out on the sea, the birds flying about and singing, the sun, the sky. Being sucked down is the sepulchre turned into the watery grave of a tide rising up from the ends of the earth to attack the living. Every minute means further entombment. The poor bastard tries to sit down, to lie down, to crawl. Every move he makes buries him. He straightens up, he sinks down. He feels himself being engulfed. He screams, implores, cries out to the clouds, wrings his hands, despairs. There he is waist deep in the sand. The sand reaches his chest. He is no more than a bust now. He raises his arms, groans furiously, clutches at the beach with his nails, tries to hold on to that ash, leans on his elbows to tear himself out of that soft sheath, sobs frantically. The sand rises. The sand reaches his shoulders. The sand reaches his neck. Only his face is visible now. His mouth shouts. The sand fills it. Silence. His eyes still gaze. The sand shuts them. Darkness. Then his forehead diminishes. A bit of hair flutters above the sand. A hand pops up, pokes a hole in the surface of the beach, flaps and shakes, then disappears. A man has been sinisterly erased. Sometimes the rider gets sucked down with the horse. Sometimes the carter gets sucked down with the cart. All sink beneath the beach. It is a shipwreck out of water. It is land drowning the man. Land, permeated by the ocean, becomes a trap. It offers itself as a plain and opens itself up like a wave. The abyss goes in for such treachery. This fatal experience, always possible on this or that ocean beach, was also possible 30 years ago in the sewer of Paris. Before the major works begun in 1833 got off the ground, the underground network of Paris was subject to sudden cave-ins. The water trickled down into certain underlying pockets of particularly friable soil. The channel floor, whether made of paving as in the old sewers or of hydraulic cement over concrete as in the new galleries, having lost its support, buckled. A buckle in a floor of this nature means a crack. A crack means collapse. The channel floor would give way over a certain distance. This crevasse, a gap that was a gully of sludge, was known in the specialized language as subsidence. What is subsidence? It is the quicksand of the seaside suddenly encountered under the ground. It is the beach of Mont Saint-Michel in a sewer. The saturated soil behaves as though molten. All of its molecules are in suspension in a soft medium. It is not soil and it is not water. And this sometimes to very great depth. There is nothing more awful than such an encounter. If water is predominant, death is swift. You are simply swallowed up. If soil is predominant, death is slow. You are sucked down inch by inch. Can you imagine such a death? If being sucked down is appalling on a beach by the sea, what can it be like in the cloaca? Instead of the open air, bright sunlight, broad daylight, that clear horizon, those vast sounds, those free clouds raining down life, those boats just visible in the distance, hope in all its forms, people probably going by, help possible up until the last minute. Instead of all that, deafness, blindness, a black vault, the inside of a grave already and waiting, death in a bog under a lid, slow suffocation by feculence, a stone box where asphyxiation opens its claws in the mire and grabs you by the throat, fetid air mingling with your death rattle, slime instead of sand, sulfured hydrogen instead of a hurricane, ordure instead of the ocean. And you call out, and you grind your teeth, and you writhe and struggle and agonize with this enormous city that is completely ignorant of all this, sitting there just above your head. No words can express the horror of dying like this. Death sometimes redeems its atrociousness by a certain terrible dignity. At the stake, in a shipwreck, a person can be grand. In flames, as in foam, a superb attitude is possible. You are transfigured in going down into the abyss. But not here. Death is dirty. Expiring here is humiliating. The last things you see floating by are base. Muck is synonymous with shame. It is small, ugly, vile. Die in a ton of Marsala, like Clarence, if you have to. In the night carter's ditch like Descoubleau? No. That is horrible. To struggle in it is ghastly. While you are fighting for your life, you squelch around, paddling. It is dark enough to be hell, viscous enough to be no more than a slime pit, and the dying man can't tell whether he will turn into a specter or a toad. Everywhere else, the sepulchre is sinister. Here, it is grotesque. The depth of subsidences varied, as well as their length and density, depending on how bad the quality of the subsoil was. Sometimes a subsidence was 2 or 3 feet deep, sometimes 8 or 10. Occasionally, the bottom could not be found. The muck would be almost solid in one place, almost liquid in another. In the Lunière subsidence, it would have taken a man a day to disappear, whereas he would have been devoured in 5 minutes flat in the Felipeau bog. Sludge's load-bearing capacity varies with its density. A child can get away where a man is sunk. The first law of salvation is to shed any kind of weight. Chuck your tool bag or your sack or your hod. That was the first thing a sewer worker did when he felt the ground giving way under him. Subsidences had different causes. The friability of the soil, a landslide at a depth below human reach, the violent showers of summer, the endless downpours of winter, long drizzle patches. Sometimes the weight of neighboring houses on a marly or sandy ground bore down on the vaults of the underground galleries and caused them to warp, or else the sewer floor would burst and crack under the crushing pressure. The compression caused by the Panthéon obliterated in this way, a century ago, a section of the vaults of Montagne Sainte-Geneviève. When a sewer slumped under pressure from houses, the chaos occasionally translated at street level as a sort of saw-toothed split between paving stones. This rent would snake all the way along the cracked vault, and then, since the problem was visible, it could be promptly fixed. Just as often, the internal ravages did not reveal themselves by any external scar, in which case, woe betide the sewer workers. Stepping carelessly into the caved-in sewer, they could lose their lives there. The old records make mention of well-sinkers buried alive in this way in subsidences. They list several names, among others the name of a sewer man who got bogged down when the sewer caved in under the square in the Rue Carême-Prénon, a man named Blaise Poutrin. This Blaise Poutrin was the brother of Nicolas Poutrin, who was the last ditch-digger of the cemetery nicknamed the Slaughterhouse of the Innocents in 1785, the period when that particular cemetery died. There was also the young and dashing Vicomte d'Escoubleau, we just referred to, one of the heroes of the Siege of Lérida, where they mounted the attack in silk stockings, violins leading the way. D'Escoubleau surprised one night at his cousin's, the Duchesse de Sourdis, drowned in a quagmire in the Beautreuil sewer where he had sought refuge from the Duke. Madame de Sourdis, when told of his death, asked for her smelling salts and forgot to weep. She was so busy sniffing the salts. In such cases, no love can hold up. The cloaca snuffs it out. Hero refuses to wash Leander's dead body. Thisbe holds her nose in front of Pyramus and lets out a pooh. The subsidence. Jean Valjean found himself faced with a subsidence. This type of cave-in was then frequent in the subsoil of the Champs-Élysées, which did not really lend itself to hydraulic works and was not very good at preserving underground structures because of its excessive fluidity. For inconsistency, this fluidity is even worse than the sands of the Quartier Saint-Georges, which could only be defeated by a layer of dry stone revetment over concrete. Even worse than the clay beds contaminated with gas of the Quartier des Martyrs, which are so waterlogged that the passage could only be dug out under the Galerie des Martyrs by means of a cast-iron pipe. When, in 1836, they demolished, in order to rebuild it, the old stone sewer under the Faubourg Saint-Honoré, where we see Jean Valjean tangled up at this moment, the quicksand that forms the subsoil of the Champs-Élysées right down to the Seine was such an obstacle that the operation lasted close on 6 months, to the great hue and cry of local residents, especially those residents who owned mansions or coaches. The work was more than grueling, it was downright dangerous. It is true that it rained for 4.5 months, and that the Seine flooded 3 times. The subsidence that Jean Valjean encountered was caused by the downpour the day before. The paved floor, poorly supported by the underlying sand, had buckled and blocked the flow of storm water, producing a flood. Seepage had occurred and collapse had followed. The broken-up floor had subsided into the sludge. For how long a stretch? Impossible to say. It was darker here than anywhere else. It was a mud hole in a cavern of pitch-black night. Jean Valjean felt the pavement give way under him. He stepped into the mire. It was water on the surface, sludge at the bottom. He had to get through it. To go back the way he had come was out of the question. Marius was dying and Jean Valjean worn out. What other way was there? Jean Valjean ploughed on. Besides, the bog did not seem too deep for the first few steps. But the farther he advanced, the deeper his feet sank in. He was soon knee-deep in sludge and more than knee-deep in water. He trudged on, holding Marius as high as he could with both arms above the water. The sludge now came up over his knees and the water to his waist. It was already too late to turn back. He was sinking deeper and deeper. The sludge was dense enough to hold one man's weight, but evidently could not bear two. Separately, Marius and Jean Valjean would have had a chance to get out. Jean Valjean continued to advance, holding up the dying man who was perhaps already a corpse. The water came up to his armpits. He felt himself foundering. He could hardly move, the muck was so deep. Its density, which was its load-bearing support, was also the obstacle. He kept Marius aloft and, with an unbelievable show of strength, made headway. But he was sinking fast. Now only his head was out of water and the arms that held Marius aloft. In old paintings of the flood, you'll see a mother holding her child in the same manner. He sank even deeper, throwing his head back to avoid swallowing water and to be able to breathe. To anyone there in the darkness, he would have looked like a mask floating in the dark. He dimly caught sight of Marius's head hanging down above him and his livid face. He made a desperate effort and thrust his foot out. His foot hit something solid. A foothold. High time. He straightened up and twisted round and rooted himself firmly on that support in a kind of fit of fury. It was, for him, like the first step of a flight of stairs leading back up to life. The support, encountered in the muck just in the nick of time, just as he was about to go under, was the start of the other side of the sewer floor that had folded without breaking up and buckled under the water like a board in one piece. A well-built pavement forms an arch, and is good and solid like this. This fragment of the floor, partly submerged but solid, was a veritable ramp, and once he was on the ramp, Jean Valjean climbed up the inclined plane to the other side of the bog. Emerging from the water, he hit a rock and fell to his knees. This seemed fitting to him, and he stayed there a while. His soul plunged in we know not what words to God. He got to his feet, shivering, frozen, rank, bent under the dying man he was lugging, all streaming with muck, his soul full of a strange light. Sometimes we have run aground when we think we have landed. He set out again once more. But if he had not left his life behind in the subsidence, he seemed to have left his strength there. That last supreme effort had polished him off. He was now so weary that every three or four steps he was forced to stop to get his breath, and he would lean against the wall. Once he had to sit down on the bank of the channel to change Malleus's position, and he thought he would never get up. But if his vigor was gone, his spirit was not. He got up. He walked on, in desperation, almost fast, went about 100 paces in this fashion, without lifting his head, almost without breathing, when all of a sudden he banged into a wall. He had reached a sharp bend in the sewer, and, arriving at the turn with his head down, had struck the wall. He looked up, and at the end of the tunnel up ahead in front of him, a long way down, a very long way down, he saw a light. It was not the terrible light of before, it was good white light. It was daylight. Jean Valjean could see the way out. A damned soul, suddenly spotting the way out of Gehenna, from the middle of the blazing furnace of hell, would feel what Jean Valjean then felt. They would fly frantically with the stumps of their burned wings toward that radiant door. Jean Valjean no longer felt tired. He no longer felt Marius's weight. His calves once more became calves of steel. He didn't walk, he ran. As he approached, the exit stood out more and more distinctly. It was a circular arch, not as high as the vault, which got smaller by degrees, and not as wide as the gallery, which got narrower at the same time that the vault got lower. The tunnel ended like the inside of a funnel, tightening severely in imitation of the gates of houses of detention. Logical in a jail, illogical in a sewer, and since corrected. Jean Valjean reached the exit. There he stopped. It was indeed an outlet, but there was no way out. The arch was sealed off by a heavy gate, and this gate, which, to all appearances, rarely turned on its oxidized hinges, was held fast in its stone frame by a heavy lock, red with rust, that looked like an enormous brick. You could see the keyhole and the robust sliding bolt driven deep into the iron staple. The lock was visibly locked with a double turn. It was one of those fortress locks that were rampant in the old lock-crazy Paris. Beyond the gate, there was the open air, the river, sunlight, the embankment, very narrow but wide enough to get away, the distant quays, Paris, that bottomless pit where a person can so easily hide, the wide horizon, freedom. To the right, downriver, you could make out the Pont d'Aina, on the left, upriver, the Pont des Invalides. The spot would have been just right for waiting till nightfall and escaping. It was one of the most deserted places in Paris, the embankment fronting the Gros Caillou. Flies came and went through the bars of the gate. It might have been 8:30 in the evening. The day was coming to a close. Jean Valjean laid Marius down along the wall on the dry part of the floor channel, then went up to the gate and gripped the bars with both hands. The shaking was frenetic, the shock non-existent. The gate did not budge. Jean Valjean seized each bar one by one, hoping to be able to tear out the least sturdy and use it as a lever to lift up the gate or break the lock. Not one bar shifted. A tiger's teeth are no firmer in their sockets. No lever, no possible purchase. The obstacle was invincible. There was no way of opening the gate. Must he end it all there, then? What to do? What would happen to them? Should he go back? Do the frightening course he had already covered all over again? He did not have the strength. Besides, how could he cross that bog once more, when it was a miracle they had got through it in the first place? And after the bog, what about the police patrol? He would not escape that lot twice, that much was certain. And anyway, where would he go? What direction would he take? Following the downhill slope did not mean reaching the goal. Should a person make it to some other exit, he would find it blocked off by some other plug or grate. All the exits were indubitably sealed off in this fashion. Chance had unsealed the grate by which they had entered, but obviously all the other sewer outlets and manholes were shut tight. They had only succeeded in escaping into a prison. The jig was up. All that Jean Valjean had done was useless. God would not have it. They were caught, the two of them, in the gloomy immense web of death. And Jean Valjean could feel that horrible spider running along the trembling black threads in the darkness. He turned his back to the gate and flopped down on the stone floor, flattened rather than sitting next to the ever-motionless Marius, and his head sank between his knees. No way out. As far as anguish went, this was the last straw. Who did he think of in his profound devastation? Not of himself, nor of Marius. He thought of Cosette. The torn bit of coat. In the middle of his annihilation, a hand clapped on his shoulder, and a voice that was low said to him, "Go you halves." Was there someone in that gloom? Nothing is more dreamlike than despair. Jean Valjean thought he was dreaming. He had not heard any footsteps. Was it possible? Could it be? He looked up. A man was planted in front of him. This man was dressed in a smock. He was barefoot. He was holding his shoes in his left hand. He had obviously taken them off to approach Jean Valjean without being heard. Jean Valjean was not in doubt for a moment. As unforeseen as the encounter was, the man was known to him. The man was Thénardier. Although woken up, so to speak, with a start, Jean Valjean was used to being on the alert and on the lookout for unexpected blows that you have to swiftly parry, and he once more, and without further ado, regained his presence of mind. Besides, the situation could hardly get any worse. At a certain level of distress, a crescendo was no longer possible, and even Thénardier could not make the night any blacker. There was a moment's silence. Thénardier raised his right hand to his forehead and shaded his eyes with it. Then he knitted his eyebrows together as he blinked, which, along with a slight pursing of the mouth, typifies the sagacious attention of a man straining to place another man. He did not succeed. Jean Valjean, as we say, had his back to the light and was in any case so disfigured, so covered with mud and blood, that at high noon he would have been unrecognizable. On the other hand, lit up from the front by the light coming through the gate, which shone full in his face, the light of a cellar, it is true, livid but sharp in its lividity, Thénardier, as the lively, if trite metaphor has it, stood out plain as day to Jean Valjean. This imbalance in the situation was enough to ensure Jean Valjean had an advantage in the mysterious duel that was about to begin between the two men in their two opposing camps. In the encounter that took place, Jean Valjean was veiled and Thénardier unmasked. Jean Valjean saw right away that Thénardier did not recognize him. They studied each other for a moment in the half-light as though each was taking the other's measure. Thénardier was the first to break the silence.
"How are you going to get out?"
Jean Valjean did not answer. Thénardier went on,
"No way you can pick the lock. You've got to get out of here, though."
"That's true," said Jean Valjean.
"Well, then, go your halves."
"What do you mean?"
"You've killed the man, fine. Me, I've got the key."
Thénardier pointed to Marius. He continued,
"I don't know you, but I'd like to help you. Only you've got to be a friend."
Jean Valjean began to understand. Thénardier took him for a murderer. Thénardier resumed,
"Listen, comrade, you didn't kill this geezer without seeing what he had in his pockets. Give me my half, and I'll open the gate for you."
And pulling a huge key halfway out from under his badly torn smock, he added,
"Would you like to see how the key to freedom's made? Here it is."
Jean Valjean stayed dumb. The expression is Corneille the Elder's, to the point of doubting that what he saw was real. It had to be Providence taking on a horrible guise, with the good angel crawling out of the ground in the form of Thénardier. Thénardier thrust his fist into a big pocket hidden under his smock, fished around, pulled out a rope, and held it out to Jean Valjean.
"Here," he said, "I'll throw in the rope while I'm at it."
"A rope? What for?"
"You'll need a stone, too, but you'll find plenty outside. There's a heap of rubble out there."
"A stone? What for?"
"Idiot. If you're going to throw this mug in the river, you'll need a rope and a stone. Without 'em, it'll bob up and float on the water."
Jean Valjean took the rope. There is no one who hasn't taken what they are offered without thinking. Thénardier snapped his fingers as though he'd just had a brainwave.
"Ah, right, comrade, while I think of it, how the hell did you manage to get out of the bog back there? I wasn't taking any chances myself. Phew, you stink."
After a pause, he added,
"I'm asking you questions, but you're right not to answer. It's your bit of an apprenticeship for the cursed quarter of an hour in front of the examining magistrate. And then again, if you don't talk at all, you don't run the risk of talking too loud. It's all the same to me, just because I can't see your face and don't know your name. You'd be wrong to think I don't know who you are and what you want. I know, all right. You've knocked this gentleman around a bit, and now you'd like to tuck him away somewhere safe. What you need is the river, the great cover-upper of stuff-ups. I'm about to get you out of your predicament. Help out a mate in trouble, that's right up my alley."
While applauding Jean Valjean for holding his tongue, he was clearly trying to get him to speak. He gave his shoulder a shove to try and get a look at him side on, and cried, though without raising his voice above the middle register he favored,
"Speaking of that bog hole, you're a bit finicky, aren't you? Why didn't you just dump the geezer in there?"
Jean Valjean remained silent. Thénardier went on, hoisting the old rag that served him as a cravat up as far as his Adam's apple, a gesture that completes the capable air of a man to be reckoned with.
"Actually, you probably acted wisely. When the workers come tomorrow to patch up the hole, they'd have found the poor sucker left there for sure. And bit by bit, one way or another, they'd have been able to sniff you out and track you down. Someone's come through the sewer? Who? How'd he get out? Where? Did anyone see him come out? The police have got eyes in the back of their heads. The sewer's treacherous and gives you away. Such a find is a rarity. It attracts attention. Not many people use the sewer to go about their business, whereas the river's anybody's. The river, that's the real cemetery in this town. After a month, they fish up your man for you in the Saint-Cloud nets. So who gives two hoots? It's a decaying carcass, for Christ's sake. Who killed the man? Paris. And the law doesn't even put up a notice. You did the right thing."
The more loquacious Thénardier was, the more mute Jean Valjean. Thénardier shoved his shoulder again.
"Now, to conclude our business, we'll divvy it up. You've seen Mikey, now show me your dough."
Thénardier was haggard, smelly, sleazy, a bit threatening, yet friendly. One thing was strange. Thénardier's manner was not natural. He didn't look entirely at ease. While he didn't exactly affect an air of mystery, he kept his voice low. From time to time he placed a finger over his mouth and murmured, "Shh." It was hard to guess why. There was no one there but the two of them. Jean Valjean thought that other bandits were perhaps hidden in some recess not far away, and that Thénardier was not too keen to share any spoils with them. Thénardier resumed.
"Let's get it over with, then. How much did this dunce here have in his pouch?"
Jean Valjean felt around in his pockets. It was, as you will recall, his custom to always have money on him. The grim life of expediency that he was condemned to lead made this a rule for him. This time, however, he was caught off guard. In donning his National Guard uniform the night before, gloomily absorbed as he was, he had forgotten to take his wallet with him. All he had was a few loose coins in his waistcoat pocket. It only amounted to 30 or so francs. He turned his pocket inside out, all soaked with muck, and then set out a gold louis, 2 5-franc pieces, and 5 or 6 gros sous on the curb of the channel floor. Thénardier thrust out his bottom lip with a significant twist of the neck.
"You didn't kill him for much," he said.
He started to pat, in all familiarity, Jean Valjean's pockets, followed by Marius's pockets. Jean Valjean, concerned above all with keeping his back to the light, let him go ahead. While he handled Marius's coat, Thénardier, with the dexterity of a conjurer and unbeknownst to Jean Valjean, managed to tear off a strip that he hid under his smock, probably thinking that this piece of cloth could later serve him to identify the man killed and the killer. Otherwise, he did not come up with a sou more than the 30 francs.
"It's true," he said. "The two of you together, that's all you're good for."
And forgetting his phrase, "go you halves," he took the lot. He did hesitate a bit before the gros sou, but upon reflection, took those too, grumbling,
"Bugger it, it's knifing people too cheap."
This done, he pulled the key out of his smock once more.
"Now, friend, you can go. It's just like at the fair here. You pay as you go. You've paid, now go."
And he started to laugh. In offering a stranger the aid of this key, and getting some man other than himself out through the gate, did he have the pure and disinterested intention of saving a murderer? That is something you may be forgiven for doubting. Thénardier helped Jean Valjean get Marius back on his shoulders. Then he headed for the gate on his bare feet, tiptoeing, beckoning to Jean Valjean to follow him. He peered outside, placed a finger to his lips, and remained sort of suspended for a few seconds. The inspection done, he put the key in the lock. The bolt slid, and the gate turned. There was no squeaking, no grating. It happened very smoothly. Clearly the gate and the hinges were carefully oiled and opened more often than you would have thought. The smoothness was sinister. You could feel in it the furtive comings and goings, the silent entrances and exits of nocturnal men and the wolf-like tread of crime. The sewer was evidently in cahoots with some mysterious gang. That taciturn gate was a receiver of stolen goods. A fence. Thénardier cracked the gate open, left just enough room for Jean Valjean to squeeze through, then shut it again, turned the key twice in the lock, and plunged back into the darkness, quiet as a breath. He seemed to walk with the velvet pads of a tiger. A moment later, that repulsive savior had melted back into the invisible. Jean Valjean found himself outside. Marius looks to be dead, to one who knows. He let Marius slide down onto the embankment. They were outside. The miasmas, the darkness, the horror were behind them. The healthful, pure, vital, joyful, freely breathable air flooded him. All around him was silence, but the lovely silence of the sun going down in the bright blue sky. Twilight had fallen. Night, that great liberator, the friend of all those who need the cover of darkness to surface from some torment, was on the way. The sky offered itself everywhere you looked as an enormous calm. The river lapped at his feet with the soft smack of a kiss. You could hear the overhead dialogue of birds in their nests, bidding each other good evening in the elms of the Champs-Élysées. A few stars, feebly punctuating the pale blue of the zenith, and visible only to daydreamers, made barely perceptible points of splendor in the infinite vastness. It was that undecided and exquisite hour that says neither yes nor no. It was already dark enough for a person to be able to be lost from sight in it, at some remove, and still light enough for a person to be recognizable up close. For a few seconds, Jean Valjean was irresistibly overcome by all that awesome yet soft serenity. Such moments of forgetting occur. Suffering stops harassing the miserable. All worry slips away. Peace wraps the dreamer like night. And in the glow of twilight, the soul twinkles with stars, mimicking the sky as it lights up. Jean Valjean could not help but contemplate this vast, bright darkness above him. Pensive, he bathed in ecstasy and prayer within the magnificent silence of the eternal heavens. Then, swiftly, as though a sense of duty was coming back to him, he bent down to Marius and, scooping up some water in the palm of his hand, gently threw a few drops over his face. Malleus's eyelids did not lift, but he breathed through his half-open mouth. Jean Valjean was about to plunge his hand in the river again, when, all of a sudden, he felt strangely uneasy, as you do when you know someone is behind you, even though you can't see them. We have talked about this feeling, which everyone is familiar with, before he wheeled round. Someone was indeed behind him, just as there had been a moment ago. A tall man, wrapped in a long redding coat, with his arms folded, the lead knob of a club showing in his right hand, was standing a few feet behind Jean Valjean as he crouched over Marius. There, in the gloaming, it seemed to be a sort of apparition. A simple man would have been frightened of it because of the gathering dark, and a reflective man because of the club. Jean Valjean knew that it was Javert. The reader has no doubt guessed that Thénardier's tracker was none other than Javert. Javert, after his unhoped-for exit from the barricade, had gone to the prefecture of police, had given a verbal report to the prefect in person during a brief audience, then had immediately resumed his duties, which involved, you will remember the note seized on him earlier, a certain surveillance of the right bank embankment at the Champs-Élysées, which had excited the attention of the police for some time. There he had spotted Thénardier and followed him. You know the rest. You will also understand that the gate that so obligingly opened for Jean Valjean was a bit of cunning on Thénardier's part. Thénardier could smell that Javert was still around. A watched man has a scent that does not let him down. He had to throw the bloodhound a bone. A murderer, what a godsend! It meant cutting his losses, which is an option a person must never turn down. Thénardier, in shoving Jean Valjean outside in his stead, gave the police a bit of bait, threw them off his own scent, got himself overlooked in a much bigger hall, rewarded Javert for waiting, which always placates a police spy, earned himself 30 francs, and found a means, one he was certainly counting on, of bolting with the aid of this diversion. Jean Valjean had gone from one pitfall to another. These two encounters, one right after the other, first Thénardier, then Javert, shook him up. Javert did not recognize Jean Valjean, who, as we say, did not look himself at the moment. He kept his arms folded, quietly ensured his club was firmly in hand, and said, in a calm, brisk voice, "Who are you?"
"Me."
"Who is me?"
"Jean Valjean."
Javert stuck the club between his teeth, bent his knees, leaned forward, placed his two powerful hands on Jean Valjean's shoulders, clamping them like two vices, examined him, and saw that it was him. Their faces were almost touching. Javert's gaze was terrible. Jean Valjean remained inert under Javert's grip, like a lion submitting to the claws of a lynx.
"Inspector Javert," he said, "you've got me. Besides, since this morning I've considered myself your prisoner. I didn't give you my address in order to try and get away from you. Take me. Only grant me one thing."
Javert seemed not to hear. He bored into Jean Valjean with his hard stare. His puckered chin pushed his lips up toward his nose, a sign of fierce musing. Finally, he let go of Jean Valjean, straightened up all in one go, took his club fully in hand, and, as in a dream, murmured more than spoke these questions. "What are you doing here, and who is this man?" He continued using vous rather than tu in addressing Jean Valjean. Jean Valjean answered, and the sound of his voice seemed to wake Javert.
"He is precisely what I wanted to speak to you about. Do what you like with me, but first help me get him home. That's all I ask you."
Javert's face tensed the way it did whenever anyone believed him capable of some concession. Yet he did not say no. He bent down again, pulled a handkerchief from his pocket, and wiped Malleus's bloody forehead.
"This man was at the barricade," he said in a small voice, as though speaking to himself. "He's the one they called Marius."
A first-class spy, The man had observed all, heard all, absorbed all, and retained all. Believing himself about to die, he went on spying, even at death's door, even with one foot in the grave, he went on taking notes. He seized Marius' hand, looking for a pulse.
"He's one of the wounded," said Jean Valjean.
"He's one of the dead," said Javert.
Jean Valjean answered, "No, not yet."
"So you carried him here from the barricade?" observed Javert.
He must have been very preoccupied indeed, for him not to dwell on this troubling rescue via the sewer, not even to notice Jean Valjean's silence at his question. Jean Valjean, for his part, seemed to have only one thought. He resumed.
"He lives in the Marais, Rue des Filles du Calvaire, with his grandfather. I forget the name."
Jean Valjean fumbled in Marius's coat, pulled out the wallet, opened it at the page penciled in by Marius, and handed it to Javert. There was still enough light floating in the air to be able to read by. Javert, moreover, had the cat-like phosphorescence of night owls in his eyes. He deciphered the few lines written by Marius and muttered,
"Gillenormand, Rue des Filles du Calvaire, number 6.
Then he yelled,
"Driver!"
You will remember the fiacre was waiting, just in case. Javert held onto Marius's wallet. A moment later, the carriage, which had come down the watering-hole ramp, was on the embankment. Marius was lifted onto the back seat, and Javert was sitting next to Jean Valjean on the front seat. When the door was shut again, the fiacre pulled away rapidly, going back along the quay in the direction of the Bastille. They turned off the quay and into the streets. The driver, a black silhouette on his box, whipped his bony horses. Icy silence inside the fiacre. Marius motionless, his body propped up against the back corner, his head lolling on his chest, arms dangling, legs stiff, appeared to be waiting now only for a coffin. Jean Valjean seemed to be made of shadow, and Javert of stone. And in this carriage full of night, whose interior turned a livid white as though struck by intermittent lightning every time it passed a lamp, chance seemed to have brought together in grim confrontation three tragic immobilities: the corpse, the specter, and the statue. Return of the Son Prodigal with his life. At every jolt from the pavement, a drop of blood fell from Marius's hair. Night had closed in by the time the fiacre pulled up at number 6, Rue des Filles du Calvaire. Javert was first to set foot on the ground, took in at a glance the number above the porte-cochere, and lifting up the heavy wrought-iron knocker, embellished in the old-fashioned way with a billy-goat and a satyr clashing, gave it a violent bang. One side of the double door cracked open a little, and Javert gave it a shove. The porter stuck his head out, yawning, vaguely awake, candle in hand. Everyone in the house was asleep. They go to bed early, the Marais, especially on days when there's a riot on. This good old quartier, scared stiff by the revolution, takes refuge in sleep, just as children, when they hear the boogeyman coming, quickly duck their heads under the covers. Meanwhile, Jean Valjean and the driver lifted Marius out of the fiacre, Jean Valjean holding him under the armpits and the driver under the knees. While he was carrying Marius in this fashion, Jean Valjean slipped a hand under his clothes, which were pretty much torn to shreds, and felt his chest to reassure himself that his heart was still beating. It was even beating a little less feebly, as if the motion of the carriage had produced a certain return to life. Javert called out to the porter in the tone appropriate for the government to take with the porter of a troublemaker, "Anyone here by the name of Gillenormand?"
"That's here. What do you want with him?"
"We brought his son home for him."
"His son?"
said the porter in a daze.
"He's dead."
Jean Valjean, who came up behind Javert, ragged and dirty, and whom the porter regarded with some horror, motioned to him with his head that he was not. The porter did not seem to understand either Javert's words or Jean Valjean's signs. Javert continued,
"He's been at the barricade, and now here he is."
"At the barricade!" cried the porter.
"He's gone and got himself killed. Go and wake up the father."
The porter did not budge.
"Go on, then,"
Javert barked, and he added, "There will be a funeral here tomorrow." For Javert, the usual incidents of the public highway were classified according to category, which is the basis of foresight and oversight. And every eventuality had its pigeonhole. The possible facts were filed away in drawers, so to speak, from where they emerged as the occasion arose in variable quantities. There was, in the street, a bit of a racket, a bit of a riot, a bit of a carnival, a bit of a funeral. The porter went no further than waking up Basque. Basque woke up Nicolette, Nicolette woke up Aunt Gillenormand. As for the grandfather, they let him sleep on, telling themselves he'd find out soon enough. They carried Marius up to the first floor, without anyone, moreover, knowing anything about it in the other parts of the house, and they laid him out on an old sofa in Monsieur Gillenormand's antechamber. And while Basque went off to look for a doctor and Nicolette opened the linen cupboards, Jean Valjean felt Javert tap him on the shoulder. He understood, and went back downstairs with Javert, following hot on his heels. The porter watched them leave just as he had watched them arrive, in drowsy horror. They climbed back up into the fiacre, and the driver onto his box. "Inspector Javert," said Jean Valjean, "grant me one more thing."
"What?"
asked Javert rudely. "Let me go back to my place for a moment. After that you can do what you like with me." Javert remained silent for a few moments, with his chin tucked into the collar of his coat. Then he pulled down the window in front.
"Driver," he said, "Rue de l'Homme Armé, No. 7.
The Absolute rocked. They did not open their mouths again the entire trip. What did Jean Valjean want? To finish what he had started. To warn Cosette, to tell her where Marius was, perhaps give her some other useful information, and make, if he could, certain final arrangements. As for himself, as for what concerned him personally, it was all over. He had been nabbed by Javert and did not resist. Anyone else in such a situation might perhaps have thought vaguely of the rope that Thénardier had given him, and of the bars of the first dungeon that he would enter. But since the bishop, Jean Valjean, when confronted by any violence, including against himself, felt a profoundly religious hesitation. We cannot stress this point enough. Suicide, that mysterious assault and battery against the unknown, which may to a certain extent involve the death of the soul, was impossible for Jean Valjean. At the entrance to the Rue de l'Homme Armé, the fiacre stopped. The street was too narrow for carriages to be able to go in. Javert and Jean Valjean got down. The driver humbly pointed out to Monsieur l'Inspecteur that the Utrecht velvet of his carriage was all stained by the blood of the murdered man and by the mud of the murderer. That was what he had understood, anyway. He added that some kind of compensation was due to him. At the same time, pulling his notebook out of his pocket, he begged Monsieur l'Inspecteur to have the goodness to write down for him a bit of a statement to that effect. Javert pushed away the notebook the driver held out to him and said,
"How much do you need, being on standby, and the trip itself included?"
"There's 7 1/4 hours," answered the driver, "and my velvet was brand new, 80 francs, Monsieur l'Inspecteur."
Javert took 4 napoleons out of his pocket and sent the fiacre packing. Jean Valjean thought Javert intended to conduct him on foot to the Blancmanteau guardhouse, or the Archives guardhouse, which are both close by. They stepped into the street. It was, as usual, deserted. Javert followed Jean Valjean. They reached No. 7. Jean Valjean knocked. The door opened.
"Good," said Javert. "Go up."
He added, with a strange expression, as though it cost him quite an effort to speak in such a way,
"I'll wait for you here."
Jean Valjean looked at Javert. This way of doing things was not at all in Javert's repertoire. Yet the fact that Javert now displayed a sort of arrogant confidence, the confidence of a cat allowing a mouse the freedom of the length of its claw, resolved, as Jean Valjean was, to give himself up and have done with it. This could hardly surprise him much. He pushed the door, stepped into the house, shouted to the porter who was in bed and had pulled the cord from his bed without getting up, "It's me!" and mounted the stairs. When he reached the first floor, he paused. All painful paths have their stations. The window on the landing, which was a sash window, was open. As in many old houses, the stairway let in the light and looked onto the street. The street lamp, standing exactly opposite, threw light on the stairs, and that meant economizing on lighting. Jean Valjean, either to take a breath of air or simply without thinking, stuck his head out the window and leaned out over the street. It is a short street, and the lamp lit it from one end to the other. Jean Valjean felt suddenly dizzy with amazement. There was no one there anymore. Javert had gone. The Grandfather. Basque and the porter had carried Marius into the salon, and he was still stretched out motionless on the sofa where they had first laid him. The doctor, who had been sent for, had come running. Aunt Gillenormand had got out of bed. Aunt Gillenormand came and went, aghast, clutching her hands, unable to do anything but mutter, "God, is it possible?" She added an occasional, "Everything will be covered in blood." When the initial horror had subsided, a certain philosophical attitude toward the situation came over her and was translated into this exclamation. It was bound to end this way. She did not go so far as the "I told you so" that is customary on such occasions. On the doctor's orders, a camp bed had been set up next to the sofa. The doctor examined Marius and, after establishing that there was a persistent pulse, that the wounded man had no deep stab wounds in his chest, and that the blood at the corner of his mouth came from his nasal cavity, he had him laid out flat on the bed without a pillow, his head level with his body, and even a bit lower, and his chest bare to facilitate breathing. At the sight of them undressing Marius, Mademoiselle Gillenormand withdrew. She began saying her rosary in her room. Marius had no internal injuries. A bullet, absorbed by his wallet, had swerved and raked across his ribs in a hideous gash, but without going deep, and so without danger. The long trip underground had completed the dislocation of his broken collarbone, and there were serious complications there. His arms had saber cuts. No scar disfigured his face. His head, on the other hand, was badly hacked about. What would become of these head wounds? Did they stop at the scalp? Did they eat into the skull? It was not yet possible to say. One grave symptom was that they had caused unconsciousness, and you don't always recover from unconsciousness of the kind. The hemorrhaging, moreover, had worn the wounded man out. But below the waist, the lower part of his body had been protected by the barricade. Basque and Nicolette ripped up linen and prepared bandages. Nicolette sewed them, Basque rolled them up. There being no lint, the doctor had staunched the blood flowing from the wounds with wads of cotton wool for the time being. Beside the bed, three candles burned on a table where the surgical instruments were spread out. The doctor washed Marius's face and hair with cold water, a full bucket turned red in an instant. The porter stood by, his candle in hand, providing the light. The doctor seemed lost in sad thoughts. From time to time, he shook his head as though answering some question he had silently put to himself. They were a bad sign for the sick man, these mysterious conversations the doctor had with himself. Just as the doctor was wiping Marius's face and gently touching his still closed lids, a door opened at the back of the salon, and a long, pale figure appeared. It was the grandfather. For 2 days, the riot had strongly agitated, outraged, and preoccupied Monsieur Gillenormand. He had not been able to sleep a wink the night before, and had had a fever all day. That evening he had gone to bed far earlier than usual, advising that everything in the house be locked up, and he had finally dozed off from sheer fatigue. Old men's sleep is fragile. Monsieur Gillenormand's room was next door to the salon, and no matter what precautions they may have taken, the noise had woken him up. Surprised at the crack of light he saw under his door, he had gotten out of bed and groped his way along. He was standing at the half-open door with one hand on the doorknob, his head tipped forward a little and wobbling, his body wrapped tightly in a white dressing gown as rigid and wrinkle-free as a shroud, astonished, and he looked like a phantom peering into a tomb. He saw the bed and on the mattress this young man, covered in blood, white with a waxy whiteness, eyes closed, mouth agape, lips pale, naked to the waist, slashed to ribbons with dark red wounds, lying there motionless under harsh light. The grandfather shivered from head to toe, as much as ossified limbs can shiver, and his eyes, their corny